Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia, and it's the 30th of August 2012. Great to be with you today. We have an incredible show prepared for you today. In the second hour, I have the famous Syrian girl who's been heading up the charts in YouTube and doing some fantastic interviews on InfoWars and other places. She's coming on our show for a full hour to break down the Syrian situation, to give us a Syrian person's perspective on what is really going on there, what is the nature of the conflict, and what is the nature of the foreign interventions. And I'm really going to ask her to break down the internal intricacies of whatever sectarian disputes there are in Syria, because I think it's really important that we convey to you all the information that we have. Of course, my position has always been, based on my research, that massive foreign intervention, both overt and covert, is going on to destabilize Syria, which I think is completely unacceptable and a complete travesty of justice and democracy and international law and, you know, dozens of other principles that we could throw up. But of course, there are probably other sides to this. There probably are internal disputes, as there are in any country. And I think it's important to understand those, to understand the whole picture. Because of course, the great game, as it's often been called throughout history, that's what they called it back in the British Empire. The great game has always involved using sectarian disputes as a means of engaging in control. And it is a sophisticated technique, and despite everything we've learned from history, it still seems to work. A lot of countries, especially in that part of the world, seem to fall for it. And it's an incredibly disappointing situation that after so many hundreds of years of learning these lessons, that we still have to keep learning these lessons. But that's Syria coming up in part two of the hour. I'd like to welcome to the studio George, who's going to be with us for the next hour. George, are you there?
I certainly am. How are you, Heroin?
Look, I'm superb, George. I'm in a really good fighting form today. I'm really charged up, and I'm ready to accelerate into the future. You know, my sights are set in the far distance. Like an archer. You know, you aim for bullseye, right?
Yep.
And you know you're probably not going to hit bullseye, but you don't think that, because of course, if you think, oh, I'm not going to hit bullseye, then you're even less likely to hit it, right?
That's right. As an archer,
you always aim for bullseye. My aim is bullseye. Bullseye means we liberate the occupied countries that are occupied by the totalitarian fascist New World Order and restore democracy, liberty and freedom. What do you say to that?
We thought the number of wars around the planet in past centuries were large in number, even making allowance for the fact that we didn't have the joys of mass media back then. But I was doing a bit of research last night concerning how hostilities have developed in the world, and even during the British Empire, the Raj and their interventions throughout the planet, back in their heyday, there wasn't as much hostility generated or undergoing as there is currently in the world. And we know about Syria, we know about Iraq, Afghanistan, we know about noises around the various areas of the Middle East, we know Israel and their neighbours, Russia and Chechnya. So we're not really privy to all the activities that take place, but we know that in many countries around Africa and such, there are a lot of problems. And certainly now that these massive oil fields are still not quite out there on the east coast of Africa, running down past Kenya all the way up to fairly well touching Saudi Arabia, this is going to cause some destabilizing in East Africa that we haven't quite seen yet.
So it seems like, George, you're saying that the great game, as it were, is still being played with perhaps more intensity than ever by the would-be empires of this world. Now, I mean, what's your take on this sad march of history, where we've seen for hundreds of years, probably thousands of years, how these relatively simple techniques of manipulating and controlling populations through through exploiting the divide and conquer technique still continues to be used. I mean, isn't that incredible?
Well, you've got third parties. You've got person number A going along to person number B and whispering and saying person number C is not really good and he's really out to get you anyway. And if number B believes it, then he's going to be used by A to go and attack C. So you can run along to number C and tell him the same thing about B, and you could end up with supplying both sides, similar to the Napoleonic Wars, if I might review a bit of history there.
Indeed.
And we saw this also in the... In the backdoor activities of the Second World War with Nazi Germany, we saw some activities there that hinted of supplies going to both sides, as we saw more recently in Iran-Iraq fiasco, which was partly exposed. I might just shot in a little point of history there that might cause a little bit of dissent.
Go ahead.
But, Edward VIII abdicated... not because he wanted to marry an American divorcee, Wallace Simpson, but more to do with leading aspects of the Britain elite towards a support of Nazi Germany. Now, there is historic support for that. There are documents that reveal that information. So that's a little point there too. So they were playing both sides of the equation. As we know that Roosevelt didn't quite want to go into the Second World War. The domestic vote there wasn't in that direction. So Churchill went had his little meetings with Roosevelt and convinced him that, that this should be a good outcome for all concerned. And, of course, at the end of the Second World War, virtually all major industrial bases or foundations in the world were destroyed. So the only one standing of any substance was the United States. So it was obvious that after the Second World War, the US would become... the world leader, the preeminent empire, the largest industrial foundation. So, of course, that happened, that moved forward, and we saw through the Marshall Plan and other activities the further evolving of Germany and Japan as the second and third largest economies in the world. So we've seen a lot of this take place. So out of the destruction and the washes of war that take place, we see other stars or other elements rising up out of this. We've got a lot of situations that don't really hit the front lines as in Papua New Guinea, the Timor situation concerned oil in the Timor Sea. Papua New Guinea is very rich in resources.
If we can just stay on the larger picture for a moment, George,
yep.
I'd really be interested for you to just gaze into your crystal ball, as I know you can. And you've talked about the demise of the previous empires and the rise of the current empire.
Yeah.
I mean, can you? Opine or predict as to what will occur in the future? I mean, are we going to see the demise of the American empire? Are we going to see a transfer of this massive military capability perhaps to some other entity which is not exactly the United States? Do you see that as a possibility? Because this is something I've been thinking about.
We had the British Empire, then we had emerging with the
because the British Empire kind of merged. Sorry to interject.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out one thing: is that the British Empire more or less merged into the US Empire, didn't
yes.
it? And I'm you see, there wasn't like a collapse and then a new one started. What actually happened? It was kind of a transference, and that makes the current empire all the more powerful and huge because it kind of built on the framework that had been created by the British Empire. But please do continue.
All right. You had the evolution of the Anglo-American Empire, which is in many regards the last empire. Now, America controls the military aspect of that alliance. And this will upset a few folks now. England controls the financial aspects of the planet, so that will definitely upset a few people.
Interesting point.
Yeah,
thank you.
There's a lot of evidence for that, and as you know, I was involved in certain aspects of the financial industry in past years.
Indeed.
Now, so that will continue through. So a lot of what we see concerning resources grabs around the world does have these two major players involved. America supplies the muscle for what's occurred, and a lot of and the technology also. So we see a lot of this. There is a changing in that. Now, I'll go out on a little bit of a limb here. We've got the New World Order. We've got NATO. We've got the UN. I see Europe, even though it looks like it's not too healthy at the moment, I see Europe as rising as a major empire, not in contradiction to the US or Britain, but as part of that particular alliance. I see Russia and Asia as isolated areas, but Russia is very strong and very powerful. And I believe just at this moment, Russia has the military edge on the United States. And that changes a few equations too. We need to look at their leading edge fighter aircraft, their leading edge missiles. The Su-27 is I believe, far superior to the Raptor, and there are a lot of advances there. Much hasn't been revealed. So on a one-for-one basis, I think that Russia is not going to be challenged at any time in the foreseeable future. Asia rising as an empire, it's a trading empire. We saw after the Second World War the total destruction of Japan. Japan moving forward as an industrial giant. Economically, that follows through. So although Japan was helped by the US after the Second World War, it certainly developed its technologies. It managed its banking in an interesting manner. The Japanese people were always mad savers. They saved money. Money went piling into banks, always. Now, the Japanese government was smart enough to give a tax discount for people who saved money through their banks. So, of course, the already swollen banks were bourgeoising even further. So we had a lot of money in banks that could allow those banks to lend money to industry in Japan to develop technology and to export. So they were aided along for export. Japan started to pull in considerable amounts of foreign exchange because of this. It took them decades, of course, to do this, but they came forward as a very strong industrial base. And between Germany and themselves were second or third largest economies in the world behind the United States, and that since the end of the Second World War. So it's to do with a better management than what we experience monetarily, fiscally, regulatory, in regulatory manners in Australia and the US. And
George, we are just heading to break. We probably have to move on now with some other news. I've got some important Australian news.
Yep.
So we'll be continuing with that. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Hereward Fenton. It is really excellent to be with you today. Don't go away.
Getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back. You're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia. Beaming out across the planet and across the universe through the cyber frequencies, reaching all intelligent life forms. And we extend our greetings to all, whether you be human, humanoid, or indeed any other intelligent life form, as long as you don't bear us any ill will, we certainly don't bear you any. Now, it's time to turn to our national news, desk, and I've got Georges there on the national news desk.
How are you?
Welcome back, George. We're going to be playing for you today a clip from Kuzu Media, a great little Australian-based news outfit which presents very, very compact and dense news coverage of suppressed information. And I really, really do encourage you to check out Kuzu Media. They've done a lot of great stuff. They also do a lot of commercial voiceover stuff and a lot of advertising, but and I don't really know much about them. I don't know who runs them. It's a bit of a mystery because they keep a very low profile. Do you have any clues on that, George?
No, I think it's the people who have found a consciousness for the what we call the human condition.
Yes.
Who are involved with advertising and media, and
they've been inspired.
Yes, and this is being done on the side. So there are people with some facilities who are using them to what they believe to be a better advantage, and we see a value in it for all of us. Certainly, that.
Let's without further ado, let's actually play the clip here from Kuzu, and then we can talk about it afterwards. So this is a clip from Kuzu Media, which highlights some of the recent developments with the carbon tax and some new research that has been done into the effects of the carbon tax on our economic future. Here we go.
I'm Rowana Ruiz in Manila for Kuzu News and Commentary. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard's Labor government claims Australians will not feel the recently introduced carbon tax. However, it's dawning on many that the newly introduced carbon tax is going to cost far more than what was bargained for. Indeed, it will cost in unintended ways they couldn't have imagined. Gillard may have in fact ignited a rural property boom. Imagine making a $6.5 million property investment which returns $20.5 million in 1 year or less. Today we do the numbers and show you how it's done. Australian air carrier Qantas has entered into an agreement to buy more than a million tons of carbon credits from Henbury Station in Central Australia. RM Williams Agricultural Holdings bought the 527,000-hectare station for $13 million in 2011. The Australian federal government has contributed $9 million to the Conservation Zone project, which will see the Northern Territory station destocked and restored to a natural landscape. Qantas Environment Issues head John Velastro says it's the first time the airline has sourced carbon credits in Australia. He says the agreement will go a long way in fulfilling the airline's liabilities under Australia's carbon pricing scheme, which is newspeak for the carbon tax. Remember, if you can't elect to pay the carbon price, shop for it or use an alternative. Then it's a mandated tax no matter what governments call it. Again, paraphrasing Velastro, he went on to say, what makes this one quite unique is the size and the scale of what they are doing in terms of the methodology they're using to actually generate the credits. He also said, it's about revegetating and repurposing the land. We see that as a powerful use of the sourcing of carbon credits. Tell that to Australians shopping for food in the supermarkets and who are already struggling with higher than ever electricity prices. Food comes from rural Australia's productivity, not supermarkets.
Just going to pause it there. I just want to get your comment, George. I mean, this seems to be the trend of the way in which the carbon taxes are being implemented, part of this Agenda 21 deindustrialization or kind of conversion of land that was once productive land to be non-productive. It's really hard to see that outside of the context of a population reduction goal as well, but we don't see the full agenda at any one point in time. What's your take on that?
All right. As in all these matters, there are two realities. It's one which is released for mass consumption. We've got a global warming situation. We need a carbon tax. We've got experts. Isn't this good? Now, behind that, you've got the business people and the banking cartels who are going to be trading this in this emission scheme market. Now, what's happening here, and as Kuzu has indicated, a lot of smart players are going to go around and buy up these lands, just for example, using Australia here.
Yes.
Buy up these lands. Now, the lands that they've bought up are not good agricultural lands. You've got Australia is predominantly desert, and they can't contain the amount of cattle or sheep on these properties as indicated, particularly cattle. So some useless land is sold by R.M. Williams, a manufacturer of shoes, to an airline.
Okay.
They're going to repurpose, I like the terminology, repurpose this land so that they claim that they've got a million tonnes of carbon credits, and the government is going to tip in for that as well. So down this journey, as we saw previously in Australia with the rort, which was called the superphosphates bounty, which is a big story in itself, this opened up an avenue for some smart boys to get in there, buy up some dead land, pull in some money from the government, and then sell it off or make it available to other companies who need these alleged carbon credits. So you're going to see some backdoor deals. Some of it's going to come out. People in the street are going to be complaining, and the government is going to distance the situation of what's occurring there with the carbon tax and the global warming. So there's going to be two parallel agendas running, and very, very few people will tie those two together. Now, as with the superphosphate bounty, which was a bounty or funds given by the Australian government to farmers to agriculturalists who had land that was basically couldn't be used for anything. They were given money by the federal government in Australia to run superphosphate over their properties. Some bought the stuff and used it, some didn't. Many millionaires were created in Australia in the political and government industry, and a few smart boys in business concerning this superphosphate bounty. It was taken out by the previous Labor government, and as soon as Fraser came in, it was in 1974, he reintroduced it immediately. Many millionaires were formed out of this superphosphate bounty.
Sounds like you're saying that this was a pretty much a plain old rort, a plain old scam. They're simply manipulating the environmental laws for their profit.
Yep.
And perhaps you don't see any deeper agenda beyond that, and I think you might be right. Let's actually just continue playing a bit more from the clip here, and we'll see if we can get any more deeper into it.
Right.
So what's happening in Australia? Does this mean Julia Gillard imposed a tax on Australia that will progressively see productive agricultural land, which feeds the nation, taken out of food production service? What does this mean for the nation being able to independently feed itself, let alone the cost of food, as land comes out of production because it's more profitable to repurpose the land?
Now, just pause it there again, because the argument being presented here, which again is different to what you're saying, George, but
yep.
I think you're probably both right. You're, of course, saying that, well, this land really wasn't very productive. And so by removing this land from agricultural productivity isn't really going to have much of an impact. But, you know, what if we started seeing more prime agricultural land started to be treated in this way? I think we'd then start to actually have to agree with the thesis of this video that this is really going to have an impact on our future as our ability to sustain ourselves. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, behind the scenes, there are other agendas evolving. The smart boys are starting to see there's a dollar in this carbon tax fiasco, which has been perpetrated. So the banks are involved. Some players are going to be involved with real estate. They can buy something for $2 million, get a government kickback for doing something cute for the environment, and end up that becoming dropped into the emissions trading scheme for many millions of dollars more. So there's going to be a lot of activity in that regard. It will move up from the useless land which is currently being brought into play to land that instead of growing fruit and vegetables, we can make a quick dollar out of it doing it this way. And unfortunately, government with its monetary, fiscal and regulatory policies has created the situations of let's get the dollar in today. No, we're not going to worry about that land and planting these fields and doing that for 5 to 10 years from now. There's not enough money in it. So government interfering in the economy, as it does, causes these aberrations.
Going to break, George, right. Unfortunately. We'll continue with this and a very, very important subject, of course, for our future. With Truth News Radio Australia, don't go away. A lot of good news and analysis coming up in the next half hour. Back, ladies and gentlemen, you're with Truth News. It's great to be with you today. Please check us out on the internet if you have a chance. You can find us at www.truthnews.com.au. A great site. It's got all our podcasts on it. You can search back going about 4 years. We've covered many, many topics. And if you go to the website and have a look at the category section on the right-hand side, if you kind of scroll down the page a bit, you can see all the categories of topics we've covered. We've done a lot of good interviews there, and it's quite a good resource. So I do encourage you to take a look. And, of course, if you're getting this by podcast now, you may wish to join the show live next time. And you can do that simply by going to the site and clicking on the big link that says Listen. Click here. Right at the top of the page, and you'll go to our live stream page where you can play the live show in a variety of players. Whether you're on a Mac or on a PC, you should be able to play it. Now, I would like to just continue where we left off there, playing this clip from Kuzu Media documenting the way in which carbon taxes and land use policies are conspiring to rob Australia of its agricultural land. And this is a combination, of course, of a straight-out rort, a straight-out scam by savvy business people with a lot of power and clout, but, of course, propped up by an intellectual framework which goes back to Agenda 21, the UN plans for building a new future with a downgraded industrialization and a general direction towards population reduction. Of course, you know, the question is how do we reduce population? Agenda 21 derives from the previous sort of generation of environmental alarmism, which did center around population growth. And that was, of course, in the late 1960s, groups like the Club of Rome. And there were books like The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. And, of course, Paul Ehrlich was the co-author of the book Ecoscience, which is the other author of which is currently the science czar for Obama in his administration, in which it was proposed that the population growth had to be curbed by all kinds of means, including the imposition of a world government, sterilizing people, putting sterilants in the water supply, requiring people to have a license to have children. Now, all of these measures, of course, are measures to reduce population. But, of course, if you pull out the food base, if you pull out the agricultural base, that will also produce population reduction in a much more dramatic way if you start to get major famines. Of course, we don't have that problem in this country now, but the trend is there, and it's a very, very worrying one as we start to depend more and more on imports from overseas. I mean, a huge amount of our food in our supermarkets here comes from overseas, including fresh vegetables. You go into a major supermarket here in Sydney and the tomatoes come from China. You know, the lettuce comes from China. I mean, it's incredible to think that it's actually still profitable and preferable for them to put all this stuff on planes and fly it over than it is to grow locally here. But in a way, that has been engineered to be that way by the robber barons, by the totally corrupt, ruthless people who we have allowed to get in control of everything in our society. And they're setting that up for their benefit. They're benefiting from it. We're suffering. And, you know, the reason why it was allowed to happen was because we let it happen. And this is something I try to put forth in my shows, and I really want to try and emphasize it again today. This is not a question of us sitting here and blaming some corporate tyrant and saying, you know, you're to blame, it's your fault. This is a question of us recognizing we allowed the slippery slide into tyranny by not stopping it and not nipping it in the bud. And every day we let it go by, every day we go by without taking action, without doing something, it gets worse and worse and worse. So my goal is not to point blame at powerful people or robber barons and say, you know, you're the bad guys, you know, and let's lynch the robber barons and everything will be okay. No. That won't solve the problem. Those may be bad people, but if you don't wake up, if you don't take action, if you don't take responsibility, within a year, there would be all of those slots would be filled again. If we killed all the bad people, your inactivity, your apathy would simply provide an opportunity for more ruthless people to jump up and take over. Can I just get your take on that, George?
Yeah, I seem to remember a phrase coming back from the great history of the United States called eternal vigilance.
Indeed.
And when we allow that to slide, the results are as we see. There are a lot of activities, the environment, global warming is a surface. That's what's visible. There is always another agenda. No one's going to fall in line. Businesses, banks, international players, big money is not going to drop in line and say, oh, well, this government has passed these environmental laws. We need to do that or this. Say, for example, a director of a major corporation that requires carbon credits. Okay, well, I've got a few lazy million floating on the side. I'll buy this land. I'll get the government to support it. I'll build up the value and I'll drop it into the emissions trading scheme. The company I'm a director of buys some of those back. They didn't buy my little tickets, but they bought some tickets and I put that into there. So I don't have to declare that I sold my company these carbon credits that I created in concert with this government. So that's opening areas which are not quite visible yet. People need to think in terms of two directions. Legislation comes in and says you can't go through door B. It didn't tell me I can't go through door C or door A to get around to the other side of door B, but it just said to me I can't go through that.
And this is how ruthless, manipulative people operate. They just exploit those little loopholes. Now,
it's
let me
on.
Actually play a little more from the clip. We've got some more Australian news I do need to cover in the hour, but I want to continue here with the clip from Kuzu News.
Does this mean that anyone can buy agricultural land for, say, $6.5 million, repurpose it for a carbon scheme of, say, 500,000 tons of carbon, and use Gillard's $23 per ton starting price to value the land at $18 million? That's nearly three times the purchase price. Add to this massive profit a further $4.5 million government conservation zone grant, and now you have $20.5 million from a $6.5 million investment. As a bonus, you might get to profit from some taxpayer-funded ecotourism venture on previously productive agricultural land. Alternatively, these once productive lands might be abandoned by developers where they take the money and run, locking once agriculturally productive land with carbon chains. One property developer had this to say about carbonizing land. He said, "Wait until the white shoe property boys hear about this latest little earner. They'll be all over it." Someone has to pay for the so-called earner. Eventually, Australians will be left to import food and pay spiraling energy prices, whilst global bankers and speculators have the carbon emissions trading scheme they've always dreamt about. A scheme of taxing citizens without them knowing it. A privatized taxation system under the guise of free market forces as taxes passed on to the price of goods and services.
Some of the cost paid by big polluters will be passed through to the prices of the goods you buy.
Julia Gillard is absolutely right. Of course Australians won't see or feel the carbon tax. After all, wasn't that the whole idea? They weren't meant to see it or feel it until long after she has left office. As of the CPI indexing of Gillard's so-called carbon tax compensation, which is used as the basis of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission being used as an attack dog against anyone who criticizes the tax, well, the bad news is the tax won't be indexed. Compensation for the low-income earners will melt away in time, and as the carbon prices trades over the $23 per ton starting price, the open market global emissions trading scheme crushing household budgets. Gillard's 2012 compensation will become a distant memory as families struggle to feed themselves, whilst feeding the bankers who have their market-driven tax on the cost of living in an already unaffordable Australia.
Now, I'll just leave it there. You can watch the whole thing on our site. I just want to point out one thing which didn't actually get into this coverage because probably it's more recent. It was announced a couple of days ago that the carbon price in Australia has now been dropped further, and it is now being tied to the European carbon price, which is currently $10 a ton. Very quick comment on that, George. We're going to break shortly.
Yeah, it's very sad what happens, and if you
just specifically about the European parity.
Yeah, I think those numbers are going to move around as well. They're just they're short term political noises. There's no way that the people in the senior league of the rort of climate change are going to accept small numbers.
And of course, as we know, and as people like Tim Flannery have said, in order for the carbon tax to cut, to do what they want to do, it has to be much higher, because what they want to do is punish energy production. You know, that, so if it's cheap, it's not going to achieve the goals that people like Tim Flannery and the eco-fascists actually are demanding. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be back after this short break. Don't go away. Very important show. Welcome back. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to be with you today. Well, we have some more news for you in this last section before we move to the second hour, in which we will be interviewing Syrian Girl, a very, very important interview, and she will be exposing the false flags, the foreign intervention, the covert operations, just a myriad of quite astounding evil interactions that are going on, interventions that are going on in Syria to undermine the national sovereignty of that country. And really, really looking forward to that interview. So I do hope you can join us in the second hour. Now, I just want to return to some Australian news here with Julian Assange, still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy without any sign of a way out for him. The British government, of course, has decided not to acknowledge or accept Ecuadorian asylum. They will not storm the embassy. They will refrain from that, but they will not give Assange safe passage out of the country. And of course, they now know that Assange is in there because, of course, he came out on the balcony. Up till then, none of us were really sure. We thought, well, maybe he's not there. You know, maybe he's already left the country. But of course, they know and we know, we all know that he's in there now. And the building is surrounded by police. It's a really, really serious situation. And it's my heart goes out for the man because he must be experiencing a lot of stress. And it would be very, very difficult to be cooped up in a small building like that without the possibility of even just stepping outside for a, you know, just to get a little bit of sunshine. You know, he can't even do that. He essentially is a prisoner. And it turns out that there is actually another prisoner in there with him, and I'm going to address that shortly, but there's actually another asylum seeker who's actually in the Ecuadorian embassy who's been there for quite a while. I just want to point out briefly, though, that there's a book that's been put out from a US publisher called The True Faces of Evil, We Shall Never Forget 9/11, and it's kind of like it's a children's book. This is really quite sick. I mean, it's a children's book telling children about terrorism and with lots of wonderful coloured pictures. And it's actually got little trading cards, right? And similar to those trading cards that the US military was handing out after they invaded Iraq, that basically named all of the bad guys from the Iraq regime. It's that kind of style, right? But this is actually literally aimed at children. And, you know, each card has on it the face of someone who is truly, truly evil. And so, you know, we have people like Timothy McVeigh, who was executed for the Oklahoma City bombing. We have Bill Ayers, who was involved in the Weather Underground terrorist campaign back in the 60s and 70s. We have the Beltway snipers from Washington, D.C. And among all that, we have Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And amongst all those, we have the smiling face of Julian Assange. Yes, Julian Assange is in there with mass murderers. And also we have Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. This is clearly a despicable work of pure propaganda. The fact that it's aimed at children makes it all the more obscene. You know, there's not a lot to say about it other than I just want to basically raise it for you. We will have links to that on our site. But one thing it does say to me is that they really have targeted Julian Assange, and it really is very, very sad, very, very sad situation for him. Because when you do that kind of thing, and this is obviously coming from the those who control the agendas within the policy, within the CIA, within the policies of the US government, psychological warfare department, Assange is targeted. Now, let's just briefly address the question of the second prisoner who is in the Ecuadorian embassy with him, George Georges. Can you fill us in on the details?
All right, just a little bit of history. David Kelly, who had that very strange accident and died,
yes, he slid his apparently he slashed his wrists, yes. Both of his wrists, which is considered to be virtually impossible by a number of surgeons. The way he did it, the nature of the way he slashed it, and of course he had said before he apparently committed suicide that there were people after him and that he may be found dead in the woods. But please continue.
All right, David Kelly was the arms inspector with concerning Iraq. He said there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which of course cut across a few problems there. So he committed suicide allegedly, and Richard Butler, the Australian, was appointed as arms inspector, who followed the party line. Now, there's a lady, she's currently 62 years of age, it's a lady named Tara. I'm going to give all the information here because I genuinely believe that the lady's a double agent, contrary to what others may say. So I'm going to release here a bit of information here. She's known as Andrea Davison, also known as Tara Andrea Davison. Her correct name is Elizabeth Biggs. Now, she married Davison, who was a conservative member of a parliament in Britain. And she is a MI6 operative. She was convicted for fraud and sentenced to jail for 2.5 years. She believed that her life was in danger. The fraud concerned her creating another identity for herself using MI6 facilities. And the reason for that was she wanted to disappear because She was aware of a lot of information and knew her life would be in danger. She's currently in the Ecuadorian embassy, but I'll just go back on this for a moment.
Sure.
Now, the information she wanted to release was not necessarily that which David Kelly was telling the truth. Now, I'll call her Andrea Davison, which is what she wants. So Andrea Davison was a parliamentary security advisor in matters of arms and control to the British cabinet, a very senior position. Now, the information that she had, which hasn't quite popped out, is the fact that Britain was supplying arms to Iraq, and that she had the evidence for that, and that was denied. Also, another matter concerning another agent called David Mills. David Mills was managing the some matters concerning the Italian Prime Minister and the British government with regard to what we might call money laundering. So a couple of major issues there. Andrea was called into account by a little known group called AFBO, the Association for Former British Intelligence Officers. So there was a slight dispute there. These issues are going back to about 1990, when Andrea was part of an intelligence group called Maggie's Muppets. So there's a long history there. This lady has a lot of very powerful information, a lot of politically damaging information. She's made her way into the Ecuadorian embassy there in London, and is in place there. If this is prior to Assange, so this also was not quite well known information. So what brought Assange to choose Ecuador? Not particularly what was put out into the press.
Indeed.
So I'm not sure. I need to confirm if Andrea is coming and going through the embassy there. Then that confirms my thinking that she's working for in a couple of different directions. If she's holed up there for that period of time and hasn't come out, then that gives us other information. So whether she's coming in or out, known to be coming in and out of there or not, is a pivotal point of information that explains a few other things.
We might just have to leave it there, right, George. I've got a couple of other quick stories I want to cover. We've only got a couple of minutes left in the hour. That's very, very important, and I do encourage our listeners to follow that story up. We'll put some links on the site. This information hasn't got out, hasn't been in the media. It's very, very important because it shows you that there's more sides to the standoff between the Ecuadorian government and the UK government. I just want to turn to the civil lawsuit that has been ongoing into Rachel Corrie's death, which finally came to judgment a couple of days ago. Now, Rachel Corrie, the American activist who was killed just 10 years ago today, or this year, it was in 2002 that she was killed by an Israeli bulldozer as she was trying to protect a Palestinian home from being demolished in the Gaza Strip. Rachel's family has been trying to pursue justice for this for the last 10 years. Every avenue of inquiry that they have pursued has been turned down. The Israeli military denied any fault. They then turned to a civil lawsuit, and this dragged on for several years. And finally now a judge has ruled no fault in the military investigation that cleared the defense force of responsibility. And Corrie's death was an accident for which the State of Israel was not responsible, said the judge at a Haifa district court. And that is a story from Tuesday, the 28th of August, 2012. The title is Rachel Corrie's Death Was an Accident, Israeli Judge Rules. And that's from The Guardian. It's very important to bring this up. There's nothing we can do about it. It's history now. It's ancient history, really, in the fast pace of the development of the world, of evolution of what we're seeing on the planet. But people like Rachel are so rare, and we need to celebrate people like Rachel because she did what more people need to do. She went there. She went to Gaza to offer her support. And knowing that because she's an American citizen, that if something happened to her, it would be in the media and it would give attention to the plight. She knew that, and she knew that was part of the importance of why she was there. People say, oh, she shouldn't have gone there. You know, she shouldn't have got herself into trouble. Well, to me, that's an ignorant point of view and a misunderstanding. And actually, it's kind of a shying away from the key questions here about taking responsibility. You do sometimes have to put yourself in the firing line. Sometimes you have to take a bullet. Sometimes you have to take a bulldozer. It's a very, very tragic, very, very sad story, but it has helped draw attention to the plight of the Palestinian people. So I will continue to refer to Rachel Corrie, and I want to bring her up. I want to do more shows about her. We are just at the end of the hour now. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, back with Syrian Girl right after the break. Really important interview. Please don't go away. This is extremely important.